Good to see y'all. Hello. So, I spent the last weekend at a conference in Oregon. The conference was called Gen X Dharma Teachers Conference. So we all just sat around and listened to Nirvana, and that was our practice. It was a wonderful group of people, gathering of people, obviously, around this age cohort and then being Dharma teachers. It's wonderfully diverse in a variety of ways. A lot of different Buddhist traditions were represented, different ethnicities, races, sexual orientations. So it was very sweet. And it was a great opportunity to connect with people who are different, which is good. I had this conversation with this guy from Korea named Sung-sung. And he was giving me a critique of the way we practice here in the U.S. And he was basically like, the way I understand it, the Buddhist path, you start by developing an ethical framework in which you restrict yourself. So you do, like from the view of the Eightfold Path, that would be your right speech, right action, right livelihood. You really start there and you establish your precepts, vowing not to kill, not to lie, not to steal, not to misuse sexuality, not to intoxicate the mind. And once you have kind of trained in that and established it, then you would practice meditation. And he was like, that's not how people want it. In America, they just want to jump into the meditation. And he was like, and yoga is even worse. Because if you look at the eight-limbed path of yoga, you start with yama and niyama, which are ethical systems, which are actually extremely similar to the precepts in Buddhism. And the idea, you would learn to bring your life into alignment with this set of precepts or guidelines. And then you would start to do the bendy, stretchy thing, which is called asana, which is one-eighth of the yogic path. And he was like, but in the U.S., everyone just wants to come and do bendy, stretchy all the time. Like, no good. So they just want to jump in, and they're like, oh, we're just going to meditate, and we're going to be free! Liberation! That's kind of his gesture. It was not a gesture of encouragement. So it was like, oh, yes, very interesting. I was enjoying hearing his viewpoint. And, you know, it was really striking to me because I frequently and generally refer to what we're doing here, like at this Zen Center, as an activity of liberation. So I was like, ooh, wow, liberation, bad? But that's not really what he was saying. You know, words have complex semantic meanings. He was just critiquing the idea that you should just do whatever you want, you know. And if you look at the way Zen was originally appropriated into American culture in the early 60s, there was a little bit of a just do what you want, you know. So, but you know, I talked to him and I was like, well, my idea of liberation in the Buddhist tradition is that what we are liberated from is our habits of body, emotion, and mind. That's the liberation that's being offered. It's certainly not being liberated to just do what you feel like. And also here, the way we uphold this tradition is one where we don't do a lot of like preparatory things and then do something else. We tend to, the path is presented as integrated all along. So the ethical element of the path is presented as from the beginning with the meditation. And so we, you know, Tim likes to talk about it as like a front and back foot in walking. So your ethics and your development of your ability to manifest an ethics of interdependence and compassion develops naturally with those steps forward along the meditative path. So there are different ways of doing things. That's cool. So another thing that came up at this conference was there were a number of monks, or they maybe call themselves monastics, within traditions where the requirements for being like a teacher are enormously more demanding than they are like here at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. So I was like hanging out with someone who has not personally owned anything but a robe and a bowl for 20 years. And, you know, he's like one of Thich Nhat Hanh's senior students and was his attendant for 2 years. That yielded some good stories. Anyway, he seemed very happy. And there were other people who similarly had taken up, you know, in many Buddhist traditions you have a monastic tradition where you take something like 250 precepts, which are very specific. They're not like the way we do precepts here where it's like, I vow not to lie. And then we think about, well, are there occasions where it's helpful to not, you know? It's just like, no, you don't handle money. Or, you know, no, you don't have sex with anyone. All these people that I was talking to who are in these Vinaya traditions were celibate. So that's like humbling and like kind of amazing. Wow, what a commitment. So the way they would describe whenever we were like in groups or they were presenting and they were talking about how they upheld these precepts or that they did, they'd be like, well, because I'm, you know, a Padimoksha monk. I was like, oh, Padimoksha, what's that? Padimoksha is the general term for the upholding these precepts in this formal way. And it means path of liberation. Moksha means liberation. So what do you want to do if you want to get free? Is they say, take up this very restrictive way of living that cuts out all this stuff that's about getting what I want. And that is where freedom will come from. This is probably contrary to your conditioned viewpoint. So it's just wonderful to be around these different views and see the kind of liberation that these people were manifesting, which was very beautiful. So, anyway, this is why I titled this talk, Talking About Liberation, because liberation is on my mind. And, you know, any word has this whole range of meanings. It always means something different every time it's heard. That's the basic premise of Mahayana Buddhism. There's nothing that has any fixed referent. So words are no different. When you hear a word, it's always going to mean something distinct to you in that moment. It relates to other ways of seeing the meaning, but always freshness if you're paying attention. So look at this. I brought visual aids. So you may have seen this hanging up by the bell over there. This is the four vows that we chant at the end of our Dharma talks. Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. So this is, by the way, a calligraphy by Dainin Katagiri, the founder of this practice place. And I've been traveling a lot, going to lots of different practice centers lately, and there are all kinds of people who have calligraphy by Katagiri prominently displayed. It's quite wonderful to see that connection. Anyway, the reason I got this out is because the first thing we say is beings are numberless, vowing to free them. So we're talking about liberation. So I just want to talk about this line, but I'll give you, just because I have this and it's fun, just a little quick idea of what's going on here. So I'm going to have to move this around, right? So this first line is like, many beings do not have limitation, these two. These both mean vow. So normally you have two similar characters in Chinese service as an intensifier. So and I'll turn this so you can see it in a minute. Those two characters are meant to mean what we're really talking about here is the vow. And then finally, this is a very mysterious word that we translate as free them. So that's many beings or many births do not have limitation. There's these two vow characters and then this one, which we translate as free, but I'm going to play with that. And if you look down each one of these, like if we look here, this is delusions do not have, are numberless, basically. Delusions do not have a limit and a vow to cut through them. I can't remember. How do we say that here? Extinguish. Extinguish. Thank you. There's a lot of translations. So just so you can see, this guy, this little character here is Mu. Mu. So what we have that repeats in this, that's for Zen people who are up on their Mu. Otherwise, you don't have to think about it, but there's a lot of Mu. in these things. For those of you who get down with Mu, and then there's a lot of vowing. A lot of non-self nature, a lot of vowing. That's like the key components of this. But what I want to talk about is this thing down here mostly. So I'm just going to talk about the first line because it's this freeing thing. So these first two characters, the first one means many or masses or multiple or lotsa. Probably not lotsa. It's a little informal. And then this one means life, living, or birth. Life, living, or birth. And then we get the doesn't have limitation, the vow, and then the final character. The final character here has a number of meanings that don't pertain to this. It's like, you know, synonyms in English. The main direct translation of it is crossover or pass through. Crossover or pass through. And we're saying free them. How did that happen? How did that happen? So that character down there is also a pivotal point in the Heart Sutra. The same character occurs there. The Heart Sutra says, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. This is the activity of relieving suffering, is this character. Crossover or pass through, free, relieve. So we're seeing a lot of semantic range within this. So why cross over? Because in Buddhism, the idea is we cross over from suffering to non-suffering. This is the like a central metaphor of the tradition. Samsara is one shore, nirvana is the other. So although we're going to chant this probably for the rest of my life as we're freeing beings, at the root of this meaning is the idea that there's a crossing over from samsara to nirvana or from suffering to non-suffering. The pass-through part of the meaning is very intriguing, but I don't know Chinese well enough to do much with that. And by the way, I don't know Chinese. I just know these characters. That would be my caveat. So a range of meanings opens up once we start to see this. And I'll kind of frame this line in three arrays of meanings. So first off, if we look at those first two characters, they mean many births. So the second character means birth, life, or lifetime. Many births. Early Buddhism is talking about how we are in a cycle of multiple births, and what the path is about is not being on that cycle, is ending it. And this line completely holds that way of looking at things. Multiple, many births are limitless. I vow to cross over. So the sense of an individual, as is upheld in early Buddhism, completely transcending suffering by going to nirvana, is in that line. Many births. I vow to cross over. That's not the way we're translating it or interpreting it. Because one of the wonders of the Chinese language, especially this classical Chinese, is that it's ambiguous in many ways. And one of the things that really doesn't show up is pronouns. So then you'll notice all the pronouns that show up in this are put in. So you go to a lot of places, they chant this, beings are numberless, I vow to free them. There's no I in the text. But at the same time, within that first line, the idea that there is an I that is going to go to nirvana is there. So, first sense is that births are numberless. There's this cycle of rebirth. I'm going to cross over and end it. Second is more like the way we're holding it. We're going to make that last character transitive because we want people to wake up to altruism. So we say, beings are numberless. I vow to free them. There's no them. But we say that because we're like this. We need that thing to go, oh, there's something out there to do something to or with. We're conditioned to see the world that way. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. We can say, I vow to cross them over. And actually, you can read tons and tons of Mahayana texts that say, what's our vow? To help everyone attain Buddhahood. I don't know if I want to help everyone attain Buddhahood, because maybe they don't want to have Buddhahood. So that seems a little bit paternalistic. So that sense is embedded in there of this activity that's done for. But also, none of those pronouns are there. So all these meanings can collapse into that the multiple births that I might have are the many beings. Does it matter if I will be reborn as another being in 500 years, or if there's just another being? Why does it matter if that's a manifestation of me or not? If they're suffering, I want them to be free, because I've taken this vow into my heart. So I don't. You can have the idea that it's the same you tomorrow as it is today, but finally, it's a person. Do you care about them? And the other people on this planet, we actually share this same total connectivity. There are many beings. So we can see the collapsing of the I or the you. Likewise, at the end, crossing over, does there have to be a them? Can there be an activity of liberation where there's no object that's liberated? Where we're not trying to manipulate something outside of ourselves, but we're just recognizing our total interdependence with everything, and liberation is coming up. And just to be clear, what, you know, crossing over, what is the crossing over to nirvana? A common synonym, like if you just go to the Buddhist dictionary, synonyms for nirvana: moksha, memory check. Do you remember padimoksha? It's liberation. Nirvana is liberation. Liberation from what? Very clearly and repetitively defined by the Buddha in early texts. It's not desire, not aversion, and not delusion. It's non-dukkha. It's non-suffering. So that's the direction that we're being invited to go. So I'm going to now just invite everyone to chant these vows together, which we'll chant again at the end of the whole thing, as we always do. But this time, I'd just like to do this with a style that comes more from the Tibetan tradition, where you just chant a line of text and then you just sit with it for a minute or two. It could be longer, but here it'll be a minute. And as we do this, I encourage you to be aware of how you feel in your body. And if there's mental activity, that's fine. And if there isn't, that's fine. And if you're just like, what am I doing here? Cool. There's freedom in there somewhere. So just see what happens. And you can just follow me. So I'll chant a line, we'll stop, and you can chant with me. If you don't know the chant, it's on your bulletin. And it's probably good to have your eyes closed after you chant the line.
Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it.
All right. Thank you all. It's a nice type of practice if you have a little piece of text that's inspiring or puzzling. Just hang out with it. So, liberation from these patterns of body, speech, and mind, or we could say body, emotion, and mind. That's called karma. That's what karma means. And Buddhism is kind of different than probably the way we tend to view how suffering is created, because the idea is that if there's like a painful emotional state, the reason it exists is that that or a similar painful emotional state existed in the past. And most of us probably think like there was some material reality that came together in a way that triggered an emotional state, and then your mind had chemicals in it that made a feeling or something like that. So that materialistic view that matter is fundamental is cool and helpful, but it is different than the idea that actually what's being put into the world in terms of suffering and non-suffering is the intentional energy that each of us brings in each moment. That's a really different way of looking at the world. And I don't think it needs to be, I'm not into having the only way, but it's a nice compliment to keep focusing on, like, what is the emotional energy I'm adding at this moment? And the possibility of freedom from afflictive emotion seems to manifest to me basically in two ways. One, people who do Buddhist practice tend to experience fewer painful emotional states. They tend to be less angry. They tend to be less fearful. They tend to be less desirous of things they can't get. That has been my experience. So, like, these afflictive emotional states arise less. But that's like a resultant, and you're just, that's kind of like, you don't know if that's going to happen. I have no idea what my emotional consciousness is going to produce at any given moment. But the other side of it is we can learn to just be with how we are. How cool is that? So when I'm really angry, I can be like, wow, really angry. And that's it. That's very frustrating. People are like, well, shouldn't I do something to it? But actually, it's very powerful to just be able to be there with it. Because then the emotional energy you're putting into the world is just being with things, with compassion. Because what compassion means is being with suffering. So if I can learn how to just be directly with my own suffering, the seeds I'm planting are seeds of compassion. So yeah, there's just these kind of two sides of how this freedom from afflictive emotion comes up. Decreased reactivity and a increased ability to be with, in a liberative way, whatever painful states arise. So, and then the delusion side of things is where it gets kind of freaky, because you have three basic drivers of suffering in Buddhism: greed, hate, and delusion, or desire, aversion, and delusion. So desire and aversion are the affective categories, and basically all your whole range of emotional experience is, like, within Buddhist psychology, it's all categorized within that. So fear and anger are aversive, lust and hunger are desire, stuff like that. But delusion is different. And delusion in Mahayana Buddhism is pretty radically challenging. Just good to remember that, because it says that any time that you think that there is an actual, ultimately existing, distinct thing, you're deluded. So that means all of us, frankly, are pretty much deluded all the time, really fast, because our mind is making millions of distinct things in any given moment. There's, like, walls and windows and lights and darkness and different kinds of people and ourselves. Wow. So, like, we're just this torrent of delusiveness. What a wonder it is to be human. Now, it doesn't mean that those things that our mind makes, where we think there are distinct things, are not helpful. It just means if we believe there are ultimate truths, they can really get us in trouble. That's where you see people get intense fixity of view, and it's very common. So, I'm going to shift gears here, though. So I've been talking about, like, what is it we're promoting freedom from? Is feeling alienated, because that's what dividing up the world does. It makes us feel separate and alienated. It feels like there's this thing that we always have to try and get to be how we want it, and then that feeds our emotional states. So we can find freedom from that. But then, how do we free beings? So we have these various ways of, I presented, of talking about it. One of them is kind of like our vow. So the way we translate it says, beings are numberless, I vow to free them. So we made a them. If there's a them, we made it. So how do you do that? The technical term for this in Buddhism is skillful means. Skillful means. So the idea that we recognize that even though there's not this separate thing, that's just delusive, it's helpful to use our idea that there's a separate thing so we can do something beneficial and help people be free. So there's all kinds of texts on skillful means, and they're quite wonderful. But one of my favorite catalogs of skillful means is the Gandavyuha, which is the last chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra. Just repeat that back. So I've talked about the Gandavyuha section of the Avatamsaka here a couple times because we had a study group here, so a bunch of people in this room studied it intensively last year, and Sosan Flynn came. She came from Clouds and Water and gave a talk on the same text recently. So the Gandavyuha is the story of this young monk who's like, he's got this thing down here is really happening. He's got the vow thing going. He's just like, I really want to liberate. I want liberation for everybody. How do you do it? And so someone's like, well, what I recommend is you just go talk to a lot of people who are doing it. Go have relationships with people and have liberative relationships, and they'll help you. So he goes and he talks to like 56 of these amazing bodhisattvas who have like incredible powers. And they're wonderfully diverse. There's like young boys and girls and old men and women, and there are super rich people, and there are mendicant monks, and there are scholars, and there are musicians, and there are like goddesses who fly around in the night sky. It's pretty cool. So he meets all these people, and they all have their own ways. And I'll just, I wrote down some ways that people in this manifest liberation through skillful means. They give people food. One of them, their deal is they make food and they give it to people. Pretty good. Make beauty. There are numerous ones of them who mostly what they do is they create and manifest beautiful things to liberate people. There are some who are just teachers, so they're like really, you know, they're wise. They explain stuff. There's one person who frees kajillions of people from prison. There's another person named Avalokiteshvara, who you may have heard of, who listens really deeply. And that's her activity, is deeply hearing people suffering without anything else. There's the the non-doing one who's like, I just don't do anything. And you guys are all like, sweet. But actually, I try it. One, I don't think it's possible. I mean, doing is doing. Doing does itself. Then we have the aromatherapy one. There's actually a couple, and they produce these smells that permeate through their own universes and then into other, they call them Buddha verses, other realms of different Buddhas, and it's wafting out, and the smell is liberating for people. And it's not that weird. Yesterday I walked back and forth between the Zen Center and here because I was in various parts of the ordination ceremony, and every time I walked, there would be these smells coming. I think someone told me maybe they're linden trees. They're these white flowers cascading, and they're just, a whole block will be covered in this uplifting fragrance that's sent here from this being in the Gandavyuha. Thank you, aromatherapy bodhisattva. Compassionate touch. There's one person who just, he touches Sudhana just on the top of his head, and he experiences this amazing transformation. Oh, there's some orators in there. There's one person who's just like, I'm just super happy. People like to hang out with me. It helps them because I'm really happy. It's pretty cool. There's a lot of them who are just giving stuff away. Giving, giving, giving. The one who's like deeply embedded in the forest and lives in this deep harmony with the trees that are her environment. One who their activity of liberation is giving birth. So it's wonderful. How many ways are there in order to enact this vow in the world? Many ways, many ways. So I'll give you a koan from the Pang family. This is like a Chinese, probably mythical family. One day, Layman Pang was out selling bamboo baskets with his daughter Ling Zhao. Coming down off a bridge, the layman stumbled and fell. Seeing this, Ling Zhao ran to his side and threw herself on the ground. What are you doing? Said the layman. I saw you fall, so I'm helping, said Ling Zhao. Luckily, no one was looking, said the layman. The Pang family is generally kind of funny. You're like, no, I don't know, this is some religious text, so I need to be very serious. I think the Pang family is kind of funny. But what is Ling Zhao's response when she sees her father fall? It's to join him completely. It's to go exactly where he is. So this is, to some degree, in contrast with the language that we hear in the Gandavyuha, because there's a lot of sort of doing things to or for. In skillful means, it's very easy to roll into this sort of like, I'm doing something for you. And that there's a lot of fraught things that happen with it in that I won't unpack. So Ling Zhao demonstrates a way of connecting, of being there for someone where there's no separation. I'm just there. The last line is the weirdest one. And I would say there's a tendency in Pang family stories for Ling Zhao to be very wise, and Layman Pang to be more like a trickster, like, what is going on with this guy? Because the last line is a little more puzzling, like, luckily no one was looking. So I don't know about you, I live in Minnesota, and it gets icy. You ever, like, slip on the ice, and instead of finding out whether you hurt your butt, the first thing you do is go, like, did anyone see? So, I mean, I think that this koan is pointing to that aspect of how we are. But also, Layman Pang is a trickster, and he's a non-dual figure. He's also saying, no one's looking. You, Ling Zhao, wasn't looking from the outside to see what the thing to do was, or looking from the outside at what my problem was, separate from hers, or wondering what it looked like. There was no looking from any outside to any inside. There was only action of joining, compassionate joining. So this is the same flavor I'm talking about with the third interpretation of the line of the Bodhisattva vows, where there are no pronouns. There's not a person freeing and a person freed. There's just liberation. And somehow we're stepping into that. So a number of people in this room are in our Unpacking Whiteness series, which has been going on for about 4 months. We meet monthly on Monday nights. And that has been really wonderful, powerful thing. And what this is about at its root to me is we're just exploring our own identity as people who are identified or identify as white. We're like, oh, what does it mean to be white? And the purpose is to help dismantle white supremacy, which is the condition that we live in. You know, we live in a country where white people have a very disproportionate amount of power. So the thing is, to describe why this is valuable and how this relates to what I'm talking about today, it has to do with all the assumed things that our consciousness constructs, all the delusions that we do not know are there at all, that make the world look very clearly like it is, but aren't really true. So for my experience is that a lot of people like me who are white, if I go to a place where most of the people are like black or Thai, I'm like, oh, I'm in a place with a lot of black people or Thai people. But if I go to a place where there are a lot of white people, I'm like, I'm at a place. Right? So we don't recognize that whiteness is a category or a identity status. And that's just, it has to do with how dominance transpires. So we do work here in training priests on status power that we're not aware of. So the power that comes to us for no reason other than that we happen to have inherited a certain identity category. So like as a male, there are many ways in which people kind of assume that I should get power. And I do too. And that's not cool. So I want to look in and like go, oh, what's going on in there? Can I turn my light within and kind of investigate that so that something could be transformed? So this is about kind of looking at these unacknowledged systems of power. And there's a lot going on. I just talked about a couple categories, but I think it is probable that in 50 or 100 years, people will look back at us in our time and be appalled at what we are doing to our environment. Like shocked, like dumbfounded that we could have done it with the knowledge that we had, that we could have continued to dismantle the systems that have been going on for thousands and thousands of years. Now, maybe not, but I just like to remember, like, in the United States, like, I think women have been able to vote for, like, 99 and a half years or something like that. So, you know, everyone, 150 years ago, people were like, yeah, that's fine. 150 years ago, something like that, people could own slaves in this country. So we look back and we go, oh, that's terrible. But why do we imagine that somehow we won't be in that position or we're not already in that position? That's how we are. We're conditioned as humans to not see all these unacknowledged systems of power. The power I'm talking about is power to consume products, right? So we can, if we want to liberate people from suffering, really turn around and look in and begin to take this stuff apart. And there, the tools we're talking about here, we can use tools, mindfulness tools from the Buddhist tradition. Those don't have a particularly Zen flavor. So we also can use the roots of what Soto Zen practice looks like for allowing some of these systems to dissolve. So with Soto Zen, we tend not to do analytical introspection, you know. Those tools are good, and I'm encouraging people to use them, but it's like our practice is just sit. Just sit. So Zazen is not a practice that's about trying to free someone from something. It's just about enacting liberation now, and that's very mysterious. But if we do it, you'll see your consciousness change. So because we don't add layers onto how the practice is done, the tendency of mind to always be dividing and assuming slows down a little bit. And that's why things just seem fresher. You know, you look at a tree after Zazen and it's like, wow, that can happen with the habits of your own mind. Where you go, oh, wow. So when that Korean monk is like, you Americans are doing it all wrong, I could be like, oh, wow. Instead of, no, we're right. Because we can learn to just, it's like they're just ideas. I can meet them. I can be free from the constriction of my own patterning. So Zazen is a slow process, and it's not one that gets in with there with tools and tinkers with stuff. It just allows the divisiveness of our mind to settle on its own. So, you know, this language of freeing beings can start to get kind of paternalistic. Right? Oh, I'm just going to rescue. There's these sad people who are in terrible sin. I'll fix them. Oh, not so good. I was here, though, at a Dharma talk by Reb Anderson many years ago, and someone was like, he was talking about the Heart Sutra, and someone said, so what is it that Avalokiteshvara, what's she saving them from? And he says, well, she's saving them from her own preconceptions. That's the activity of the bodhisattva. I mean, that's what the sutra lays out. You just look at this list of preconceptions you have and say none of them is ultimately true. That's like the root of our tradition. And something liberative can flow out of that. So I'm going to just do one more thing before I break up here, and that is to read you a little poem by one of my favorites, Yi Kui. Yi Kui is a 17th century Chinese Zen nun, and this is about a particular kind of freedom. Yi Kui, I will say, she really liked to just go to her hermitage and practice, and she's like, I'm so free in the nature, it's great. And then people kept calling her back and saying, we need you to enact your liberation in relationship with us. And she came back to her teacher, and she came back to her community, and she served, and then she got to get away, and they said, we need you to enact your liberation in relationship to us, and she came back. And then she writes this poem, which is her death poem. So, what is one of the most difficult, painful things we carry as human beings? The inevitability of death. And we're all going to have the grieving processes we have around it. So this isn't about like it should be this way or that. But Yi Kui shows us something about how you can meet things changing that is very beautiful. So I'm just going to read her little thing here. All her life, this fellow has been as tough as nails. Once I dug my heels in, I could not be moved. At 24, I first found out about the matter of Zen, and for 10 years struggled to forget outward appearances. At 49, I cut myself loose from the suffering world and could see through mundane affairs as if through water. I'd go to the truth of things and could leave when I wished. But I stuck to my labors for 7 more seasons of spring. Now, in front of your eyes, the iron nails will turn to dust, and the 4 great elements will disperse like wind and fire. When leaves fall, one knows autumn has come. Now is the time for me to return to the source. Ha, ha, ha! Foot loose and fancy free. That's me. All right. Well, thank you. We have a few minutes for other people to say things.
So, okay, so help me. The first line, right, that we're vowing to free them, and we're vowing to liberate all beings. And when you were talking about, say again what the last character can mean.
Crossover. Crossover. Pass through.
Right, so crossover, pass through, to me means that, like you said, you're going to attain nirvana. Yet, isn't our tradition to keep coming back?
Yeah. Well, that's why we say them, or we dissolve the individualness. So it's just infinite liberation.
Okay.
So it's like there is the meaning embedded in it of this individual liberation, but that's not all of it. Because it also leaves that I behind and just says the activity of liberation is I'm just jumping into it again.
Okay, that's helpful. One more thing with with the Korean man you spoke with. I think it's, yeah, it just dawned on me, it's very American, like going about it I could say backwards way from what he was believing is the path to go about it. But because, I mean, you know, kind of like just sitting, right? It's almost like we're so engrossed in consumerism and distraction, and that we need to not do those things for a while so we can even think about being ethical, you know, having these ethical vows, or we have to move our bodies in yoga postures, you know, in asanas, in order to even try to, like, think straight about everything else. So that was just my noticing on that. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm feeling that. The other thing I say is we all have ethical education. We're, you know, cultures do that. But most people in the United States do not have meditation. So there's some ethical framework. But yeah, thinking straight. I'm thinking that's coming soon. Yes.
You talk about ultimate truth and the sort of contrast of our materialist perceptions with truth. And we can obviously take the materialist deconstruction, you know, the wall is today a wall, but, you know, before that it was a chunk of earth, and before that the earth was stardust, and before stardust it was a nebula someplace. And we go all the way back to the Big Bang that way. But it seems to me that ultimate and truth are the sort of more interesting things to study. What do the texts of your understanding relate to those two terms, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a sort of a complex question. I will make a short answer, because that seems like appropriate to this time, which is I like the Yogacara view, which is we're going to affirm that there's an experience. So if I'm not having an experience, I'm not talking about it. And if you're not having an experience, then you're not. So what we know is true is right now there's something. Right? If there's not something, then we're not talking about how whether there's something or not. Beyond that, we have no idea. So it sadly does perfectly reflect the Bob Dylan line, there's something happening here and you don't know what it is. And then I think he wasn't talking about the same thing. But anyway, so we affirm experience as a place where liberation can happen. But then we say that we don't know what it is, so we recognize the degree to which we recognize how deluded we are. Because otherwise we get so caught on the things we think are going to make us happy and fix everything. And then there's a lot of conflict. That's my short answer. The ultimate truth, there's something here, but we don't know what it is. Yeah.
I don't know who this quote is by, and I don't even know that I'm wording it right, but the way I remember it is that the only person that ever measured me clearly was my tailor, because he re-measured me every time we met.
Nice.
Well, I think this is very interesting, but it's kind of like pointing out that this is a game and a chant, and then like getting you caught right back into it at the same time. It's like beings are numberless, and then now you have to do something to them, even though they're not there. Delusions aren't, you can't stop them, but then I vow to stop them. So I find that very interesting.
Yeah, it's a good one to live with for a good long time. I've been hanging out with these now for about 18 years, and they're still mystifying and still inspiring. So, yeah, you're right.
To the first two, like you're saying, it feel very heavy for me when I was sitting with them. It just seems heavy, where the last two to me felt more hopeful.
And just knowing how you feel is the activity of liberation. That is the most powerful one that I know. So I think we should wrap up. So thank you all very much, and I will have some announcements.